number, so that way it gives you a little bit of an idea of seeing what the trend is, whether there's a rising trend or a lowering trend, by comparing the K to the A. So is A a smooth number from K, is my question. Back to you, Mel.
Actually, in other words, the K is the constant update, which is supplied to WWV, and it's broadcast every 18 minutes, and there will be a change in the K reading every 3 hours as supplied by NOAA. In other words, they're taking these 8 measurements from a number of parts of the world, because what they're doing is they're to make their measurements as accurate as possible. I understand they take them from several spots on the Earth. And then what they do is they summate it together. So when you listen to the A, you get an idea of what is the overall condition in the last eight different measurements or the 24-hour period that go over.
Okay. Now, you said you multiply the 8Ks together. Is it possible you add the 8Ks together and divide by 8, and that gives you a smooth number? And can the A number also go between 1 and 9, or 0 and 9? Or are they literally multiplied or literally added without the division? So, yes, it's going to be smooth, but do they smooth it and renormalize, so to speak? I mean, that's the way I would do a moving average smooth number. If I want 8 consecutive numbers to be smooth in a running average, I would take the last 8 numbers, add them together, and then divide by 8. Now I get a smooth number. That's what they do when it comes to stock market charts and so on. You look at various stock market charts. You can look at the daily number, the hourly number, the weekly number, the monthly number, and so on. And as you get more and more smoothing, the curve gets literally flatter and flatter, so to speak. But it's easier to see the trend. So do they do that summation and then division? Or do they give you the raw number of just summing them? Or is it literally a raw number of multiplying? You said multiplying. I'm a little skeptical of that. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, Roger, this is KTKY. Yeah, well, mostly, as I understand it, they take the 8 times measurement a day, and then they multiply that by the K index, and that yields the A index. So that, like I say, if they had a value of 1 for each of the 3-hour periods during the 24-hour period, they would say that would be that 8 times, and each one would be approximately 3. So the 8 times 3 would be 24. Would be the daily A value. So in other words, it's summed together to what is the K index and the three-hour period, in other words, it's summed together with the three-hour period and then multiplied over the eight readings that go over.
I'd like to believe that the National Bureau of Standards has a website explaining this. NOAA has a website, or is there a section of ARRL's website or ARRL or the Antenna Engineering Handbook? To your knowledge, is there a good write-up on this that we could read if we wanted to know some of these details? Back to you, Mel.
I never really saw any definite reading of it. Basically, it comes down to understanding that 0 represents very quiet conditions and 9 represents very stormy conditions. So, basically, if you listen to WWV 18 minutes after the hour and listen to the K index, that will most likely give you the best ballpark figure. And I could say the A is basically a averaging out of all these figures together taken in the last 24 hours, and they come up with a figure. If I remember correctly, I said off the top of my head how they actually get the A index, if I could say, uh, combined situation of a number of values for each of the 3-hour period taken during the 24-hour period and then multiplied by 8, take over.
Okay, now, one of the things that's also transmitted by either NOAA or WWB, National Bureau of Standards, or NIST, as it's now called, National Institute of, is it Science Technology, what is it now? Standards and Technology. NIST is what used to be called National Bureau of Standards, although many of the people in the industry still say, okay, this is traceable to the Bureau. We still talk about the Bureau, meaning the Bureau of Standards, even though it's got a new name. NIST, Standards and Technology, National Institute of. One of the main things they give you out is a 2,800 megacycle solar flux index. What that really means is that with a radio telescope aimed at the sun, they'll tell you how much 2,800 megacycles, how much energy at that radio frequency is coming out of the sun. It's in units of watts per square meter per cycle per second. Watts per square meter per Earth. So-called Jansky number. Carl Jansky, the guy who made the very first radio telescope reading measurement way back in 1932. And he did that at Bell Laboratories. And the antenna that he used, the antenna, is now located at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. You walk over to that antenna and put your hand on it, and it's on a set of wheels. I think the antenna is about 25 feet wide. And you put your hand on it, and you can rotate the darn thing. This is what he did to find out that the radio noise that Bell Labs was getting at that time was at a certain point in the sky, and that point in the sky kept drifting a couple of degrees every day, and he soon realized it wasn't on the Earth. It was coming from the galaxy. That's what made it the first radio telescope measurement. Let me drop. But what's real handy about that solar flux number is that assume now that you and I have just built a 2.4 gig moon-bound parabolic dish antenna. And you want to find out how sensitive is your antenna, how sensitive is your receiving system. And because the antenna is so big, it might have a near-field range of a quarter of a mile. Well, you don't have an antenna range that's a quarter of a mile long. See, you think you can't make the measurement. Well, there's a beautiful transmitter in the sky called the sun. And it was, I can't think of the guy's name right now, back in 1945, right at the tail end of World War II, Southworth, I think is the guy's name, who made the first, was that his name? Somebody's eventually going to correct me on that. But there's a guy who made the very first radio telescope measurement using a radar, aimed at the sun, threw an amount of noise, and measured that noise, and said, aha. We've been looking for sun noise all these years. The end of World War II, there was a peak in the sun flux cycle. The sun was pretty noisy. So if you go to WWV for that particular hour and look at that graph and you find out what power was coming out of the sun at that frequency at that time, you aim your antenna at the sun and measure how much radio noise you measure. You're now measuring gain to temperature ratio of your antenna. You're measuring the quality of your ground station as a radio telescope. And that will give you an extremely strong clue as to how good is your ability to hear a weak moonbound signal at that frequency. And the nice thing about the sun is that the noise it puts out falls off slowly as you go up in frequency, but the 2,800 megacycle reading gives you a pretty strong clue. You can extrapolate that out to 10 gigs and figure out your 10 gig antenna. How much solar noise does it measure? And I personally have taken a number of my 10,000 meg ham radio antennas aimed at the sun, watched the S-meter go up and measure how many decibels it goes up, and that tells you something about the quality of your low noise amplifier, the gain of your antenna, and as you sweep it across the sun, if there's any side lobes, you can see that. The fact that that 12-foot dish antenna that I used to listen to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16. It needed an antenna range 300 feet long, which I didn't have, to test the antenna. I aimed it at the sun. And so 2106.4, 2287.5. The command service module of Apollo 15 was on a frequency of 22 87.5 megacycles, 2.2875 gigahertz, and listen to Apollo 15 and 16 astronauts with that antenna by tuning it up on the sun. So NBS gives you those numbers too. A index, K index, solar flux numbers. I think you have to go to a website to get some of this information. There's also a phone number by which you can get it. So lots of good information there to evaluate your antennas. In fact, there are guys who have measured the elevation pattern of their HF antenna by aiming it into the sun. Even though the antenna has no elevation control, they got it aimed at the horizon. But as the sun rises from the east, and the antenna is aimed to the east, and they look at the amount of noise coming out of their receiver by running a strip shot recorder, you can, with proper interpretation, figure out what is the elevation pattern of your antenna by using the sun. You want to choose a time when the sun is not making sudden bursts of noise. You want to choose a quiet, sun time. But it makes a beautiful transmitter, 93 million miles. The sun makes a beautiful transmitter 93 million miles away, close enough to infinity. When you're making high gain measurements on VHF, UHF antennas, you want the antenna range to be long enough. They call that the near field range or the far field range. You want the transmitter that's exciting your antenna to be in the far field, because if the transmitter is too close, portions of the antenna will be out of phase, and you get a different antenna pattern and a different apparent gain. You can't make a measurement too close. The antenna behaves differently. You start getting direct capacitive coupling and inductive coupling. So every antenna must be measured at some minimum range, unless you've got some very fancy near-field range interpretation program in operation. That's another whole story. How to make compact antenna range measurements inside of a laboratory that isn't big enough. There's a whole art and science on how to do that. And there's companies manufacturing that hardware. I know I'm off subject. Back to you, Mel. And if you think we've covered this one, and I think I'm going to do a little bit of searching during the week for some websites that give an explanation of this. I vaguely remember there was a pamphlet published by the National Bureau of Standards that gave a pretty good explanation about this jazz, published 20 or so years ago. Hopefully they've updated it. So back to you for either more on this or the next one. It's up to you. K2KEY, K2RIW. I heard Frank, and who was the other person?
KC2FYJ, Harry.
Rick, Long Beach. Okay, I heard RSO, Harry in Long Beach. KC2FYJ. Who was the third person from Long Beach?
Kilo Foxtrot 2 Tango Papa. I have information about the A and the K indexes.
Beautiful. So we're going to go through those three people at once. Frank first, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Saving the trouble of searching, there is what I believe to be an excellent website. Understanding HF radio propagation forecast, and the website address www.n0hr.com/radio_propagation.htm. If anybody needs to read on that, I'll do it again.
Okay, www.novemberzerohotelromeo.com/radio_HTM is what I think you said. Is that true, Frank?
Left out the last part. It's radio_propagation.HTM.
Okay, radio_propagation.HTM. Good sounding website. Okay, the next person was KC2FYJ. I think that's Harry. Go ahead, Harry.
Good evening. I've been listening with a great deal of interest. I was just going to let you know that there's another website which is a very, very good and easy to understand intro to on the ARRL website, www.arrl.org/cin/k9la-crop.html. It's an article written by Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA. And in it, by the way, he points out that the A index is an average of the 3-hour K indices and uses a linear scale going from 0 to 400. The K index uses a quasi-logarithmic scale, which is essentially a compressed version of the A index, and goes from 0 to 9. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Thank you for that information. Okay, KF2 Tango Papa, I think it is. Start up your name and your information, sir. Okay, extremely noisy. You were good when you first signed in. I think you've moved to another location. Want to try to move to another location and try again? Go ahead. Okay, we heard, has all the definitions, and back to you. Everything before that, you were in the wrong location, we heard nothing. Want to choose another location, and then see if we get your message, go ahead.
And I hope this works. This is www.periscope.net. Periscope. It has real-time gauges, it has all the information you need to know, plus definitions. Back to you.
Who's there?
Okay, I can tell that you're moving. We occasionally get you beautifully, and then great big gaps of not getting. Are you sitting in one particular spot with a handy talkie? Go ahead.
I'm actually immobile. Back to you, Dick.
That's the problem. Okay, right now you're good. Why don't you repeat your message, because we got essentially none of it before.
Okay, this is KF2TP, back to the net. The website is paramagnetoscope.net/realtime. It has real-time gauges, and it has all the information you need to know, and it's a lot of fun. I have it as a Google gadget. This is KF2TP, back to you.
Slash real-time. There's got to be a net or a com in there somewhere. Paramagnetic scope, why don't you give that to us a little bit more slowly. Go ahead. Okay, maybe by a Google search that's enough information. Paramagnetic scope. Looks like one way or another we're going to eventually get some good website information on this one. Now, K2KUY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is KTKY. All right, basically I'll boil down some simple factors for amateur radio use. If you want to know what the current conditions are, go to WWB, approximately, I could say, 18 minutes after the hour, get the K reading, which goes from 0 to 9, and if you want some more information on the A index, yeah, you can look up at the conversion chart that I believe NOAA does supply, that goes, as the gentleman said, I remember now, 0 to 400, and that takes in the 8 different times and converts them to one number. But if you are going to operate that day within that 3-hour period, sufficient enough is the K index for all amateur radio use. Is to know what's going on in that 3-hour period, and understanding very simple from 0 to 9, 0 being the quietest, and 9 being very disturbed. So I think that's all you have to know, Dick. Over.
Sounds good. I think we've supplied enough information on that one. Why don't you go on to the next one, though?
Hey. All right. Let's see. It's a couple of weeks ago or a month ago or whatever. You guys discussed amplifiers. Okay, we did. You mentioned Class A, Class B, and Class B amplifiers. More or less understand that. Tell me what the heck is a Class D amplifier. Okay. Well, if you know anything about Class D amplifiers, I can say a few words on it, but I'm going to leave it to you, Dick. Maybe you can say a lot more than I can. Over.
Yeah, in modern-day transistorized amplifiers, not only is there A, A1, A2, B, C, there is D, E, F, and G, literally. But let's talk about D. A Class D amplifier is one of the kinds of amplifiers which runs at much higher efficiency because the output circuit of the amplifier is running on a quasi-square wave. You know that an inverter, a square wave inverter, one that you put 12 volts into it, and it will make a square wave at 120 volts output, it's using pairs of transistors that are flipping back and forth between being fully on and fully off. And when they're fully on, there's no voltage drop, therefore no power dissipation. When they're fully off, there's no current being drawn, therefore no power dissipation. So they're producing power for you, but running at very high efficiency. A good inverter circuit can give you a square wave output at 60 hertz or 400 hertz or 100 kilohertz that runs at 90 some odd percent efficiency. No Class A, B, or C amplifier can do that. Class D can do that kind of thing. But the quasi-square wave coming out of a Class D is rich in harmonics, so it's got to be followed by a filter that only passes the fundamental frequency you're interested in and rejects all the others. Now, the Class D, E, and F are various variations on the way the waveform is generated, but it is a non-sinusoidal, high-efficiency waveform that's coming out of those higher lettered amplifiers, D, E, F, and G. And there's various ways that they do it. So it's an amplifier of high-efficiency capability, more exotic design. Usually the transistor or amplifier doing it must have much higher frequency capability. In other words, if my particular two that I want to run as a Class D amplifier only operates up to 150 megacycles, I'm not going to get very good efficiency if I use that as a 144 megacycle amplifier. However, if my tube is capable of 1,000 megacycles, and I'm using it at 144 megacycles, I can build a high-efficiency A, E, and F type of amplifier out of it. So it's a higher frequency capability of the amplifying device, non-square wave generation in the final stage, careful filtering and design. If you do it correct, you end up with higher efficiency. Not necessarily higher linearity, but certainly higher efficiency. And yes, there are pulse-width modulated versions of these, which are also capable of giving high linear
repeaters.
So I decided to say there were higher linearity versions which use pulse-width modulation of these quasi-square waves. So it's a nonlinear process capable of high efficiency is one way of looking at it. I wonder if you've actually worked with some of these amplifiers now. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Basically, just more or less upon what it's about. These ICs now that are packaged and called the D-amplifiers. And basically what they're doing is a analog signal is put into the IC. Inside this IC, basically it has the analog preamplifier that brings the signal up to a certain level. It then goes through a pulse-width modulator. Now, many of them that run at audio frequencies, the pulse-width modulator is around 1 megahertz. These are for the general, you know, amplifiers, audio amplifiers, output amplifiers, you know, that's fine. Number of the radio. Then the power output stage, which is followed from there on, basically is the signal actually, the output is average value of that signal is equal to the audio, but the peak, the peak value of the output is either fully on or completely cut off. So, you know, the output stage can basically pass the current peak. And the audio output load peak then is most likely going to be more in a situation that is going to be a much higher efficiency way of running an output transistor than using a straight analog. I don't know if I said that right. Dick, go ahead.
Yes, I think you did. That final stage can run ice cold. The whole body amplifier can run ice cold, even though it's generating 100 or 500 watts of audio. So it could be a very small package with very little heat sink, a very potent amplifier. In the case of a Class D hi-fi audio amplifier, some of them are capable of well above 90% efficiency, and even 95% efficiency, I'll bet, is achievable. So many modern-day amplifiers of that kind can be built into the loudspeaker enclosure itself. So the loudspeaker enclosure, the amplifier, all one great big module. And so, and some of those can be built with extremely good linearity. And the damping factor these are capable of generating, in other words, the output peak of that Class D amplifier can be a small fraction of 1 ohm. And just like a meter movement where you put a short circuit across it and you shake the meter will act like it's heavily damped. Well, you can do that with a loudspeaker. You can make the loudspeaker heavily damped because of what's called the high damping factor of that Class D amplifier. Very small output impedance. The loudspeaker is seeing the audio you want it to see, but when it looks back into the amplifier, it thinks it's seeing a nearly short circuit. You don't necessarily impedance back the loudspeaker if you want it to be flat in audio response. And just like that Dawson-Dow movement, you don't want the cone of the loudspeaker ringing with its audio resonant frequency. It would make a tubby sound to your hi-fi. So these amplifiers are really good, and it's something to learn about. My son built one of these as a senior project in electrical engineering school. T2KEY, T2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
It is a quick comment because a lot of these Class D amplifiers make excellent choices, not necessarily for high fidelity, but in portable applications, handheld small battery units where you need very, very long battery life, and small plastic cases, you can actually fit a fairly decent amount of audio amplifier of relatively high quality in portable devices with a very long battery life.
Glenn, mention a couple of brand names of Class D amplifiers of the kind you're talking about. How many dollars? What brand name? Where would I go to get one of those if I wanted one right now?
I'd be a little skeptical about picking out a particular brand name. I mean, you can go through Texas Instruments, make some very good national semi-mix, and I think of a couple of the others. Typically, the ICs have very, very high volume service now. Could be anything from, you know, 23 cents to $5, depending on your commercial application.
Are there any amplifiers like that in the bubble pack at Radio Shack?
I haven't seen them. The Radio Shack with discrete components hasn't been all that great. To find them, I guess probably the best place to look at them is if you have like a Mouser catalog or any of the local, like mail order.
Okay, thank you for the information. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KY. All right. Yeah, I've worked with a number of them, and I'll just tell you where to look them up and all. The one I worked with one, a 30-watt amplifier, 30-watt version called the MP7731. And, boy, I can say, compared to what was there before, basically what was there before was a Class AB amplifier. And it, you know, I can say that the difference in heat value is tremendous. And very low distortion figure. That's another thing. Very, very low distortion percentage. So now, the company, if you want to look at their website, who supplies these, if you're interested in them, remember them quite well, www.monolithic, M-O-N-O, oh, that's how you spell it, M-O-N-O-L-I-T-H-I-C.com. Did I spell monolithic correctly, Dick, over?
I think you did. Go ahead.
Hey, there's a company go to. They've got all these MP versions of them from OG, I don't know, remember. I think from little couple of watts up to 70, 80 watts, 100 watts now. And like you say, they put them right into the speakers now, the amplified speakers. So you can take a little iPod, you know, one of the little audio hotkeys like my daughters have. You plug it in and boom, you've got a speaker. You should see one speaker plugs into the other, and the whole works is inside the speaker. And you say, how the heck are they doing it? And the audio is phenomenal, over.
That's a nice way to go. Okay, on to your next one.
Last thing, that's the, the technology of right now of the audio that's in most of the modern transceivers. Let's see, I look down and I can say, I have to talk to you anyhow on the phone about something that came up here with things about TechNet and all, and the conversation I had today with Kent. So I have to remind myself to be able to talk to you on the phone either. Well, I don't know, maybe too late tonight, but tomorrow night. Let me let it drop with just a little detail, but I think it's interesting. I'm looking at buying one of those verticals. Here we go with the verticals again. Now, some of them I notice have larger diameter tracks than the others. And yet they claim that they are high Q antennas. Did you not say that the Q of a coil depends on the size of the wire and the diameter? That you said the larger, higher Q was the larger diameter and of coil size and of wire size. No? You wanna get into this again with Q, over?
Yeah, there's Q and there's Q, and it's easy to misunderstand or misuse the concept. The highest Q requirement I know of for any kind of resonator is the ones that are, the resonators that are used in a duplexing filter. The kind of filter arrangement you put on a, let's say, a 2-meter repeater, so that the transmitter and receiver are both connected simultaneously to the same antenna. Yet in the case of 2 meters, because of the 600 kilohertz of offset between repeater transmit and repeater reception, the 600 kT offset and fancy filtering, sharp skirts, can give you 120, 130 dB of isolation between the transmitter and the receiver. So that particular filter, you'd like it to have a Q of 5,000 and above. Great big cavities are required to do that. That's the extreme case. A coil all by itself has a certain Q rating at a particular frequency, which is a function of inductive reactance divided by the resistance the coil has at that frequency. That's one definition of Q. Now, you'd like the coil for a particular application to be above some particular Q minimum number. The coils that are used on vertical ground plane antennas I don't know the exact number, but maybe they need to have a queue of 300 or higher in order to serve properly. And if the minimum queue has to be 300, and your particular filter coil has got a queue of 500, and if you go through a heroic effort of making a great big coil, let me drop a much larger diameter wire and a much larger diameter coil, which has a queue of 5,000, and all it needs to be is 300, you'll get an improvement, but it's only a couple of percent improvement. So the queue requirement of the basic coil is different for different applications. If I'm using a coil as a simple RF choke to isolate the B plus or the C plus voltage I'm applying to the final stage of a transistor amplifier, and I want that to be an RF choke at my particular frequency, maybe a queue of 30 is good enough. So you got to be careful how you use the word queue. So in the application of that ground plane vertical antenna, just because one has a larger diameter coil, that the basic queue is in theory higher, doesn't mean by itself the antenna is better, because it may be beyond the minimum queue requirement for that application, and therefore the manufacturer may have done it just to charge a higher price, and it wasn't really needed. You're about to ask the question, how do I know which antenna is the best one? Well, the best information I know of is the guy at the Kings County Radio Club that periodically will take these various antennas into the field at Floyd Bennett Field, into the great big runway there, and they'll run a shootout demonstration where they'll mount them on an automobile and actually make real field measurements of signal strength and so on. That's one way to find out how well the antenna's working. Maybe it's the only way, because in many cases, whatever specifications the antenna manufacturer gave you, sometimes they're a fib. That's one of the reasons why, in the case of gain, the most important number we all want to know about, ARRL and QSC Magazine will no longer publish the claimed gain number of any antenna that's advertised in their magazine, because in the past, so many of those numbers were sent in the advertising department, not the measurement laboratory. Everybody wanted to have the highest gain because they sold the most number of antennas, and they claimed all kinds of numbers. So this is a little bit of a rundown of Q. Not a simple concept to understand what is the minimum Q for that particular application of that particular antenna design. K2RIW.
Exactly. You hit it right on the nail on the head, KUY. The only way that you're really going to know the Q of the antenna is when the antenna is up and you do a simple test. You see what the bandwidth is on that band of interest, and you know that if one antenna, if you can get this from the manufacturer, in other words, if they'll give you the bandwidth, say from 2-1 FWR through the resonant point back to 2-1 FWR, and if you take that in kilohertz, and you take the frequency, the band that it's on, and you divide it by that factor, the bandwidth factor. For instance, if it's say a 500 kilohertz bandwidth that it goes through that situation of the SWR say from 2 to 1 through resonant point through 2-1 again, and it winds up at say 500 kilohertz, and divide that by the frequency of that band, that will give you the approximate Q. So if this is basically what you're looking for, is maybe it's more bandwidth, and all this is what you got to ask the manufacturer. Them just throwing a Q number at you is not going to really make a heck of a lot of interest. Basically, I think they're over.
Yeah, Mel is now giving you the Q of the antenna as a total assembly. I'm telling you it's bandwidth. It's bandwidth where the 3-1 standing wave ratio, the Christian, 3-1, 3 dB reflection coefficient, one of the definitions of Q of a resonator is the point of the upper frequency and the lower frequency where half the power is reflected by the resonator, as opposed to resonance hopefully being a perfect impedance match. And you take the difference in those two frequencies divided by the center frequency, that's one of the definitions of Q of a total resonator system, which might be an antenna. You can also talk about the Q of the individual components of the antenna. If my particular coil has the right number of turns, or it has some particular number of microhenries of inductance, and if at my frequency that gave me an inductive reactance of 1,000 ohms, and if that particular coil, because of its diameter of wire and conductivity of wire and method of construction, had a resistance of 1 ohm, and if I divide 1 ohm into 1,000 ohms, and inductive reactance divided by resistance, I'll end up with 1,000, the Q of that coil would be 1,000. It's nice to know, but that's just one component of an antenna. And there's more to the story, as you can tell. You go a little bit crazy with this one. And Q, the reason why there's a minimum Q for a component of a transmitter, receiver, antenna, impedance matching network for a feed line, antenna tuner, they all have individual components that need a minimum Q. And once you exceed that Q, let me drop. Hopefully you get full performance of that well-designed assembly. You'll notice that the Q is a function of reactance, usually divided by resistance. And if you could make the resistance go to zero, the Q would go to infinity. The reason why you don't want resistance in a matching network is because it represents a way of dissipating energy. The resistance is the only thing that can eat up your valuable RF energy. Either that or improper shielding if it was an antenna tuner. If your antenna tuner is properly shielded, and if all of the resistance components of the network inside is a low enough resistance, then there's going to be very little loss. Now, that gives you an idea. Of all the antennas that I work with professionally, one of the things that we frequently do in order to measure antenna efficiency is quite often very difficult to measure. You'd have to have an extremely well-calibrated antenna range, know how many watts are going into it, know what the three-dimensional antenna pattern is, difficult to ascertain in many cases, and then go to a bunch of mathematics and calculate efficiency. But the bottom line of all this jazz is that if you have very high Q components and a very efficient network, it's dissipating no energy. It's wasting no energy. The only way a network or an antenna can waste energy is to burn it up by turning it into heat because there's resistance somewhere. Once you realize that, and if you're smart enough to get your hands on a thermal imaging camera, you put the right number of watts into the antenna, you aim the thermal imaging camera at every part of the antenna, and find out if anything gets hot. A good thermal imaging camera will allow you to see 1 degree Fahrenheit of temperature rise of any component of the antenna. I don't care if it's the strip line, the silver plated resonator, the high quality capacitor, the silver mica capacitor, the coil, the conductors, quarter wave matching transformer, anything that's capable of dissipating energy and wasting it can only do it by turning the RF energy into heat. And if it turns it into heat, your thermal imaging camera is going to say, aha, that's hot. It's going to glow on the thermal imaging camera. You aim your thermal imaging camera at a suspect antenna, and if everything runs ice cold, and the poor man's equivalent of this is we amateurs put 100 watts into the antenna for 10 minutes, turn off the transmitter, run over there and touch everything. If everything's ice cold, you've got an efficient antenna. It met your requirement.
Repeater, timeout.
It therefore met your minimum requirement, your requirement for minimum Q. So, where you've got a coil on your ground plane antenna, and you're worried about whether or not the manufacturer did a good job. You bought the antenna that's nice and compact, shiny, and it's not so expensive, but the coil's a little bit smaller. And you're worried that the coil's doing its job. Put 100 watts into the antenna for 10 minutes, maybe 2 minutes. Turn up the transmitter, run over there, and touch the coil. If the coil is ice cold, it met your requirement. 1 watt of dissipation for 10 minutes into a coil will make it run hot to the touch. 1 watt of dissipation out of 100 watts is 99% efficiency. Your hand can easily detect 1 watt of power dissipation. 1% loss, your hand can detect. You see how efficient, how sensitive that test is? So a poor man's thermal imaging camera is your right hand or your left hand. I've done that. Beautiful test. That's how I measured the efficiency of a UHF connector. I put a kilowatt for a UHF connector into my feed line, into my 432 antenna. Ran it for 10 minutes. The UHF connector got mildly warm to the touch. A fraction of a watt out of 1,000 watts going through it. Everybody told me UHF connectors at 432 are terrible. Well, it may create a little bit of a standing wave ratio, but it doesn't create insertion loss. It runs ice cold. Push day. K2KE1, K2LIW.
2ZEA and 2Z-Echo Alpha.
Z-Echo Alpha, I think it was. Give me the full call and your name and go ahead with your statement, sir.
I'm Glenn, November 2, Z-Echo Alpha, and I'd like to get at the end of the list of questions.
Why don't you give us your question right now?
Great. I was watching a show on TV about recycling, and they had a conveyor belt, and they were using a magnetic field to rip non-ferrous pieces of metal off the conveyor belt, and I wasn't quite sure how the process worked. Maybe you could talk about it.
Okay. As long as you've got a conductor, and you're changing the magnetic field around the conductor fast enough, you set up eddy current. So it can be a non-magnetic material, but you're changing the magnetic field around it fast enough, you'll get a counter EMF, you'll get current flowing, and therefore it is making a kind of an electromagnet. You do that process correctly by changing the magnetic field on a set of coils. You can deflect something with magnets, electromagnets, that are properly being pulsed, even though the material you've got is non-magnetic. I know that's not the whole explanation, but I wonder if you got enough of that, Glenn, to make some sense out of it. Go ahead. Would you like to try that again, Glenn?
I'm sorry. I was wondering if it's something that's possible to build on a hobbyist scale, or if this is something that's a very large industrial kind of project.
You probably heard of something called a railgun. A railgun is capable of shooting a projectile that is non-magnetic. It is making a moving magnetic field around a closed-loop conductor. By Lenz's law, the change in the magnetic field induces a current in the closed-loop conductor. That, in turn, creates a magnetic field in reverse, which becomes a part of the propulsion mechanism for a railgun. So if you study a railgun, you will be studying the basic principle of this. Guarantee if you look up the word railgun on Google, you're going to get a million hits on how to build one, and at least one of those hits is going to give you an explanation of how to do this kind of a phenomenon. Thank you, Glenn.
Okay. Now, is something like that practical to do on a small scale? What I'm looking to do is take up small pieces of glass at a lateral range.
Uh-oh. Now, to deflect something over a short period of time, easy. To pick up something and hold onto it, which is a non-magnetic material, in my opinion, that's a lot more difficult. I see where you're going here. You'd like to build a machine that you just wave it over the field and it picks up all of the spent cartridges. Wow. In my opinion, that's a lot more difficult, Glenn. I didn't say impossible. A lot more difficult. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay. On a easier basis, maybe something we could place them made out of sand, and I'm looking to just raise it to the top of the sand. They're buried maybe an inch or 2 feet.
I don't know. What you really want to do is build a rail gun in reverse. You want your rail gun not to shoot the objects outward. You want to suck them up from the ground and bring them up to the surface. I think it's possible, and if you solve the problem, I think you've got a great product that you could sell. I didn't say it's easy. I think it's possible. Back to you, Glenn.
I don't know about selling it. There's not a whole lot of rifle ranges around, but it might be an interesting way to dig up the grass.
Yeah. Now, we've all known about metal detectors that will tell you where the metallic object is, which is using a similar phenomenon, by the way. Many metal detectors will detect non-ferrous metals by making a varying magnetic field and looking for the eddy currents that the metallic object creates when it's in that varying magnetic field. That in turn changes the resonance, and that in turn tunes an oscillator off to one side. You hear a tone in the earphone, and you say, aha, I'm waving my wand over a piece of metal, start digging, and hopefully it's somebody's diamond ring. But, so detecting the presence of the cartridges is easy. Physically picking them up, transporting them through the sand, and bringing them up to the surface. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's going to be a lot more difficult. You're building a rail gun that that sucks up the bullet instead of repelling the bullet out the front end, if you know what I mean. You want to build a reverse rail gun. I think it's possible. It's going to take a lot of study. Back to you, Glenn.
I can tell from the sound of your voice, I think I'm better off with a rake. But I'll find something else to build. Thanks for the help.
Okay, now you've got it.
If you can get from, if you're trying to make a choice of a vertical antenna, take the band that, or the band, or look at the bands of interest, and ask them if they can give you the bandwidth on that particular band. Because, again, as Dick was basically saying, if you're going to wind up with a very high Q, what's going to happen? You're going to have a mixed, very narrow bandwidth to meet that will tune. And this is what a lot of these antennas that Dick was just mentioning, that the coils get hot. That's why a lot of these so-called bargain antennas or compact antennas or whatever you want to call them, they do specify the maximum amount of power that you can put into them without cooking the coils. So look for a Q, basically, I would say down fairly, you know, within reason, say maybe somewhere around, I don't know, Q of maybe about 25 or so. On the average, if they're going to, you know, rate it on Q. Basically, the other way I can think of it, again, is to ask what the bandwidth for each particular band is, and then compare the antennas and pick out the one that has the most bandwidth per band, and figure that one is the one that has the best Q factor. How's that sound, Dick? Over.
Well, I see a possible problem here, Mel. There was a kind of a dipole antenna that was made, that was advertised as being very broadband. A low VSWR antenna across all of 80 meters. Dipole-like antenna that had this black box of potted material in the center. And in reality, what was in that potted material was a matching coil with a resistor. A matching network with a resistor. And so, at the resonance center frequency, the antenna was high in efficiency. Off to one side, high or low of that, where the antenna would normally have a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio on 80 meters or a 4-to-1, you started using this coil and this resistor, and it became a dissipative antenna. The VSWR was much lower, but the antenna increased in efficiency. Not a bad design if you know what you're doing. But the people at ARRL and also a number of the amateur radio operators who eventually dissected this thing found out that there was a load resistor inside, and they got all up in arms and mad about it. And so the fact that it was a lossy antenna at certain frequency edges of the band made them unhappy. To me, that's not a bad antenna design if you know what you're doing. And who cares if it's a 3 dB down in efficiency? It's going to make very little difference in the number of QSOs you make, but it makes a lot easier to QSY with that transmitter into that antenna. You don't have to keep readjusting all the tuning and loading controls because of the way that antenna works. So I can build for you an antenna that's broadband, and because it's broadband, you'll think it's high in efficiency and high in Q. In reality, it could be somewhat lower in efficiency, depending on where you put resistors in there. So there's more to the story than first meets the eye. On top of that, all I've got to do is change the design of the antenna. I could have two antennas side by side. Let me drop. That are both nearly 100% efficient. And one of them could have twice the bandwidth of the other antenna simply because it's a different antenna design. And if it's bandwidth you want, yeah, that's an interesting measurement. You could be led to believe that the more narrowband antenna is the one that's made out of higher Q components, obvious by the fact that it has less bandwidth to it, and at least over the frequency where it operates, it has higher efficiency. I think we can get into trouble on making a somewhat simplistic measurement of 2-to-1 bandwidth, 2-to-1 Vizwa bandwidth, or 3 dB reflection coefficient bandwidth of an antenna, and interpreting that into efficiency or Q of its components. There's a little more going on, so I'm a little reluctant to give anybody a rule of thumb on this particular one now. Maybe you can, maybe it's worked. I see ways that somebody could be foxing the rules on this one a little bit. And by the way, we've got about 2.5 minutes left before they're going to close down the machine on us. K2KUI, K2LIW in the deck net.
You're quite right, Dick. But the point is that most people, that's what they're looking for, an antenna that, like you say, don't constantly have to retouch up the tuner or whatever and get the efficiency may drop off, but the better bandwidth is most likely going to be more advantageous for them to use. Where the one with the higher Q and, you know, a narrow, and all of a sudden the SWR comes flying up, and of course the transceiver, the modern transceiver, sees that in 2-to-1, and bingo, it's cutting the power back. So in that case, the antenna really becomes almost, you know, useless to you in those situations. Whereas if it's for loss of some efficiency, but gives you the greater bandwidth, I would assume would be more advantageous. I mean, that's just my opinion. Yeah, I can say, I can say, it's going to shut it, feed it down here. I have to talk to you on the phone about, well, something that semi-important stuff that came up today. And I'm wondering, is it convenient to see you tonight, or should I call you tomorrow night? This is KTKY. Back to you.
Yeah. I've got messages lined up here from my wife that that people are going to be calling me as soon as the net's over. it will have to be tomorrow, Mel. And when it comes to broadbanding antennas, I'm now in the process of writing patents for a new technique, what I think is a new technique, for making high-efficiency broadband antennas. Broadbanding a dipole, for instance, there are lots of articles on that in the ARL antenna book. Not all the information is there. There's more to that story. You haven't heard the end of that one yet. There are lossless networks, a little bit on the elaborate side, that you can add to an antenna to make it extremely broadband. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. This was segment number 1206. We'll see you next week.